Welcome to this episode of Horror Nerds at Church. This is Minisode 11, where Emily and I interview authors Robin Means Coleman and Mark Harris about their book, The Black Guy Dies First. It is a great conversation. I hope you can go out and pick out a copy of this book yourself. Just a note, there are some audio issues throughout the recording, so apologies for that, and also just a heads up to expect that. Without further ado, here is Minisode 11.
Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into a horror film and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology, where we normally do that. But this is one of our minisodes. We're going to be talking all about the book, The Black Guy Dies First, Black Horror Cinema from Fodder to Oscar by Robin R. Means Coleman and Mark H. Harris. And my name is Pace Warfield May, and I am the stoner trope who's always high and inevitably gets killed in a horror movie because I'm too high to know what's going on.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the inevitably queer-coded villain in the movies that nevertheless is amazing.
And we are joined by two awesome guests, the authors of the book. We have Dr. Robin R. Means Coleman here, who is Vice President Associate Provost for Institutional Diversity and Inclusion and Chief Diversity Officer, and the Ida B. Wells and Ferdinand Barnett Professor of Communication Studies at Northwestern University, an award-winning media studies scholar. Dr. Coleman's work focuses on provocative narratives of social justice and the cultural politics of Blackness. Dr. Coleman has published several books, including Horror Noir, A History of Black American Horror from the 1890s to Present. Second edition coming out this year. Wow. And today's book of the hour, The Black Guy Dies First, Black Horror from Fodder to Oscar, with co-author Mark Harris. Yay.
So should I say say something about me? Is that right?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, so my introduction is... I'm Robin Means Coleman, and I can say Candyman five times without fear. Candyman? Oh, wait, let me get my mirror.
Yeah, yeah. Do it legit.
My mom hates this. You see it? Candyman, 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 Candyman. Candyman!
If our listeners have not... Yeah, right. If our listeners are not too scared from that to have jumped off the podcast, worried that Candyman's going to be conjured for them too. We're joined by another guest. Emily, if you can do the honors.
Yeah, we are joined by Mark H. Harris, who is an entertainment journalist who has written about cinema and pop culture for over 20 years for New York Magazine, Vulture, Rotten Tomatoes, About.com, Pop Matters, Salem Horror Fest, Napster, oh Napster, that brings me back, Mad Adams, Pretty Scary, Ugly Planet, and I do not know how to pronounce the last one. The Indie?
The Indie.
Oh, okay, The Indie. A lifelong horror fan, he created the website blackhorrormovies.com in 2005, as the premier online source chronicling the history of Black representation and achievement in horror cinema. He was a featured commentator in the acclaimed documentary Horror Noir and the Shudder series Behind the Monster. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Mark Harris, and I'm the Black guy who doesn't die.
Yay!
Against all odds, I make it through.
For which we are grateful.
Very much so. So usually we begin with a little bit of announcements and stuff, but just for our listeners at home who don't, it's been a while since we've done a minisode. So minisodes are just like our regular episodes, but instead of going into a film and doing a deep dive, we do something else. And today's deep dive is going to be into the book, The Black Guy Dies First, which I have to say, listeners, if you have not picked up a copy, you really should. I found this book so deeply insightful, so profound, and so funny. I just love the wit that you both have throughout mm-hmm. it. So just such a great book, especially for all of our horror fans out there who listen to the podcast. And there's even a whole chapter devoted to religion and horror in Black cinema. So right in line with our podcast.
Yeah. Also super interesting from a non-horror perspective as well. So far, I admit I have not finished, but
I think that's right, Emily. It really is kind of an interesting history, both of cinema, but also Black representation in front of and behind the camera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a couple classes in college, way back in the day in college, for my women and gender studies major that were also Africana studies department, and looked into like media representation and stuff, and it's fascinating.
So just to kind of start off, what gave you the idea for this? Like, how did this book come about? If you don't mind speaking to that a little.
Well, I mean, Robin and I have kind of known each other for a while. Her horror noir book came out. When did it come out? Like 2009 or
11? It was actually on 11? The shelf in 11, but
okay.
It takes a minute for those things to come out.
Yeah, and you know, I bought the book and I was reading through it, and I was pleased to see that she gave me a shout out early in the book in her acknowledgement. So I was like, oh, that's mm-hmm. cool. And I kind of was like, oh, okay, that's that. And then, you know, out of the blue, maybe a couple of years later, she called me and just randomly, and we kind of just chatted and just talked about possibly doing something together. And, you know, it took a while, but eventually I think, you know, after the documentary based on her book came out, mm-hmm. there was interest in making a kind of a follow-up to her book. And so she was approached to do a follow-up that was a little more, I guess, less academic and a little more, has a broader appeal. So she kind of just wrote me into it to co-author with her. And so, you know, that's how it went, I think.
I love starting with Mark because I always compare notes on whether we actually have the same origin story. And in this instance, he's 100% correct. In fact, he doesn't center himself enough in his influence on the 2011 first edition version of horror noir. It really, his website, blackhorrormovies.com, I'll say that again, blackhorrormovies.com, is really such a comprehensive, accounting. It is an archive that's just such an invaluable resource to researchers. And you'll see if you visit that site where a lot of the funny in The Black Guy Dies First, where that comes from. Mark's got a wicked sense of humor and greatly benefit from that.
I love it.
Yeah.
Speaking of kind of origin stories, I'm curious to ask, we ask this question of all of our guests who come on the podcast, but do you have a real life church horror story? Because part of our podcast is talking about the horrors, the way horror and religion kind of talk to each other, but also part of our podcast is talking about the horrors of religion itself, which is its own kind of thing a little bit. So do you have any, it can be supernatural, it can be just religious horror, anything
people,
that fits
shitty
the bill.
Theology.
All of that, yep.
Well, I might be a little unique among your guests in that my father was actually a Methodist minister, so I'm a preacher's kid.
What?
So, yeah.
I'm finding this out right now. Is
that surprise?
Preacher's kid, though, is a whole different kind of experience of religion.
It's a horror story in and of itself, in some way, I guess, in that, you know, people who, you know, preacher's kids don't have a great reputation, say that. but I think my background is pretty boring as far as preachers go. And I mean, I was raised around the church regularly and Sunday school and everything. My mom was a Sunday school teacher at the church and everything. And so I was raised in it, but it really wasn't like an oppressive type of atmosphere or anything. And it wasn't really pushed on me that hard. I think my dad kind of took it. The approach was more like it's a job, and you know, we didn't he kind of went to his work, did it, came home, and he was off the hook. Basically, we didn't really pray at home or anything like that. We didn't pray like that. So it was something that just was kind of just a thing that he did, and it really didn't intersect with our home life that much, honestly. It's not really, unfortunately, I don't have really much of a horror story to cite regarding that, but I mean, it was just thinking back on it now, because I mean, I know a lot of preachers' kids have these weird home lives, and they have, you know, all the kinds of weird and stuff, and a lot of them rebelled and did their own thing, but you know, I'm not particularly religious or anything like that, but I mean, it just was kind of, I think, part of how I was brought up. It was just like, really was kind of like a job, and it was just something you did. And so I didn't really, I mean, I'm not, you know, anti-religious. I'm just kind of ambivalent to it right now. I think that, you know, was just part of my upbringing.
For sure. Yeah, I am a PK, so I have all sorts of, I have more the opposite of experience of having a mother who is very much involved in making sure we got religion correctly in our home life. So I am thankful for you that you didn't have that.
I know, I was going to say, yeah. It's not a bad thing to not have a church horror story.
No, yeah. I mean, the more I think about it, the more weird a thing I think it is, because I think most preachers' kids have a lot different experience than me. But mine was just, it was just there.
This explains so much. I had no idea.
Love it.
I do too. So I'm not a preacher's kid. My mom will hear this and she'll go, I told you this is not a denomination, but I always say I grew up Black Baptist. She's like, it's not a denomination, but I did. And my relationship with religion is quite positive, because I did sort of Bible study so early, both because also my mom was involved in that I actually was a very, very early reader. Mm-hmm. So it helped not only with sort of my ability to learn to read at a very early age, but because of the way that it was led, there was significant like challenges around critical thinking. So my mother was, you know, she was like this sort of feminist womanist from the get-go. And so there was a lot of like, and what do you think that means kind of conversation. And I'm like 4, right? So, and she, you know, I was included. So that was sort of positive. And so the one kind of connection to horror films in particular is that what was kind of out in the in universe was that if you watched certain horror films, it would open you up to like demonology and demon possession. And that was the narrative circulating around The Exorcist, that if you watch The Exorcist, you would become possessed and you would lose your way and you were going to go to hell, and it opened you up to demons, which was not the thing to tell someone who's kind of in elementary school at that point, because I became obsessed with wanting to see it. The hype around The Exorcist was so great that that was more terrifying than the actual movie. Mm-hmm. And so I had a very kind of roguish, rebellious grandmother where we would go to the drive-ins. She would hide me under a blanket so they wouldn't charge me. And then I would see horror films. And I actually thought, compare it to the hype around what could happen if you watch The Exorcist, it was kind of a letdown, because I was like, this is so cool. And, you know, I kind of got it. So that's my relationship to religion and horror, and it's also why I can say Candyman five times in a mirror.
I was just gonna say, whole new level of Candyman.
If you didn't get me with The Exorcist, I don't think you're gonna get me.
How old were you when you saw The Exorcist?
I could tell you the actual age, but that would disrupt my assertion that I just celebrated my 29th birthday. But I will say that I didn't see it in 73. I saw it because it was in the drive-in circuit as a double feature with some other things. So I was probably about 7 or 8 by then.
Perfect age.
Right. We have a running joke on the podcast that anytime that I've seen a horror movie that we're covering before the age of 12, that people take a shot for a drinking game. And anytime Emily who's new to the horror genre, hasn't seen the film before we cover on the podcast, they take a shot. So I guess, listeners, you could take a shot for Robin here watching The Exorcist before the age of 12. I love it. I love it.
Absolutely. Oh, don't get me started on the list of horror movies I saw before the age of 12.
Right. Save.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Mark? How did you get into horror as like a genre?
Well, as we've established, my parents weren't super religious with me at home, so they didn't pay too much attention to what I was watching. So I kind of just gravitated towards kind of dark storytelling, I think. And I remember borrowing from the library a VHS copy of Night of the Living Dead when I was probably 12 or so, I think. And that kind of was the early film that really got me into the genre, you know, not only from like a genre's perspective, but from a perspective of Black characters in the genre. The lead in that is a Black guy. He's really the leader of this group who are surviving the zombie onslaught. And to me, it was just this really old black and white movie. And shocking that that kind of portrayal was in a movie that was that old. So I thought it was just fascinating. It kind of drew me in, and I think went from there and expanded my horror repertoire.
We share the same origin story in this instance. Around how we got into horror, at least around the film. So I always try to outdo Mark on this and say that horror was my birthright, because for true horror heads, they'll understand if I say I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And that is, there it is. There's always someone who's like, I got it. And Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is... where Night of the Living Dead was filmed in and around the city. And then subsequently, all of the Dead series is, even if it wasn't filmed in and around Pittsburgh, that was, you know, the implied location. And I took classes at Carnegie Mellon University, where George Romero took classes. So I feel like I walk in the footsteps of Romero. And for Pittsburghers, horror is a little bit in our DNA.
For sure, for sure.
I had no idea.
Yep.
Monroeville Mall. Yeah.
Yep. I took when I was born in Pennsylvania, but more central Pennsylvania. But when I moved from the West Coast to the East Coast, one of the things I did was I drove and tried to hit as many horror spots as I could along the way. So of course I went to Estes Park to see the Overlook Hotel. They called the Overlook Hotel, right. The Stanley Hotel, and like all these different places. And of course, had to stop at the Monroeville Mall and all that on my way through Pennsylvania. So all about that. I love it. I love it. One of the things that I really love that your book covers is the way that one of the kind of like central tenets of our podcast is that horror usually draws on religious tropes or religious imagination in ways that sometimes are completely made up, sometimes are really drawing on like these deep-seated fears of good versus evil, that kind of thing. And I really love how your book devotes an entire chapter to talking about the way that religion interplays with Black horror cinema. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, in the book, there's basically two main thrusts when it comes to Black people and religion in horror. And you know, on one hand, there's voodoo, which is really kind of portrayed. It's kind of a staple of horror movies, especially from back in the day, where it's really a convenient villain, typically in the genre, that is something that kind of represents darkness and mystery. And there was, you know, a lot of popular, you know, concepts of how, you know, some evil sorcery and related to. So it's kind of something that for a long time been embedded within the genre. So discuss that a bit. And on the other hand, we also discuss Christianity and the Black Church within horror. And that, you know, kind of on the other end of the spectrum, within Black horror, Christianity tends to be more of a force of more of a revered, I guess, religion. The general concept is that, you know, Christianity is a big part of Black culture. And so I think it's kind of a very revered topic that you don't really see like you would with quote unquote white Christianity and horror. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of the kind of perverted kind of cultish storylines that out of control preachers doing all kinds of weird stuff. And I don't think you really see that so much with Black, the Black church in horror. I think an understanding that, you know, that's kind of an area that, you know, Black people don't go into, you know, you don't want to besmirch the Black church. It had a really high role within and beyond religion, been really part of like the civil rights movement and social justice. We kind of talk about both of those, and each religion has been portrayed within.
Yeah, for me, the way horror or the relationship between horror and religion, particularly Black horror, I think there's kind of, I might get this right, four themes. The first is that Mark is really absolutely spot on, obviously, because we wrote about it in the book, where Black horror in particular really treats religion quite differently. So in non-Black horror, Black religion is depicted as really deficient, as Mark said, voodoo as an example. And that, the sort of voodoo becomes all-encompassing. It could be Santeria. It could be a range of Black religions that all get sort of thrown into a pot of Black religion deficiency soup, right? Mm-hmm. And then not only is it sort of violent and deficient, but it's also infectious. And you got to watch out for Black religion because it'll get you, right? It'll be voodoo, which, you know, turns you into a possessed person, a possessed demon, or it'll, you know, it comes in and it becomes sort of an arm of Blackness that sort of particularly white people, because in these movies, that's often the target audience. It's like white people have to look out because if we, you know, it's another way to say we need to keep Black people, Black bodies out of our space and in place. I think that's the first theme around Black religion. The other is that in Black horror versus, which I make a distinction about Blacks in horror, but in Black horror, religion shows up really differently, which is sort of cleansing, redemptive, and very specific examples are ganja and Hess, death by temptation, anything made by Spencer Williams, those early 40s films, which were about, you know, sort of being upright and respectable and being, having moral fortitude. Oscar Michaud's films, all of those had this kind of religious backdrop that spoke to good and evil. What's cool about writing about horror is that, you know, the definition in and of itself, like horror movies exist because we ourselves are in this battle between good and evil. And horror either works to contain that as a cautionary tale and says, see, you stepped out of line and look what could happen. You get eaten by cannibal zombies. Or horror disrupts all of those boundaries completely and says there's a real blurring and we don't always know what good and evil looks like, right? There's not clear blue sky between the right path, the righteous path, and the wrong path. I think that's what's really intriguing about the genre. And I think as a final note, I outside of horror, I write about a lot of Black representations. And the one thing that has always intrigued me, and I'll go sort of way into unexpected territory, was Training Day. Denzel Washington's depiction, right? We needed to understand Alonzo, this character that Denzel is portraying. This is a really good movie that asks us to understand the boundaries of good and evil. And Alonzo invokes a horror movie trope to do that, right? So all along we're watching him and we're intrigued that Denzel's playing this, you know, bad person, this bad guy. And then there's the famous line where he says, King Kong ain't got nothing on me, right? To show, to mark, right? He pulls in a horror trope to say, I'm evil. I'm leaning all the way into this. And I'm going to invoke a horror film, a horror monster to make sure if you weren't clear, you are now. And one that it is so racially coded, which is Kong and the history of that monster. So I think the point is, on the whole, horror movies require us to think outside of generic genre, generic boundaries, to kind of say those guardrails aren't that firm. And horror is also a useful vehicle when someone wants to stake a claim and assert that and say, I'm evil and here, how do you know? I'm going to point you to a horror movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating. And it's interesting to me that in white horror, Catholicism is usually the church that is depicted as the good guy. And really, it's only in Black horror that Protestantism is seen as something that it can be good or healing or salvific. So I just find that distinction very strange. Why, especially in this country, which has such a weird relationship with Catholicism and kind of like a love-hate relationship with it, the fact that for some reason the Catholic Church is that one thing that we cannot touch in horror to say besmirch or say anything about. They always have to come in and save the day from demon-possessed Reagan and stuff. So just very fascinating how that plays out. Yeah. Yeah.
I think there are interesting redemptive stories in a lot of spaces, though. I'm thinking about Mark Scream, Blackula Scream, and the way Pam Grier shows up and kind of snatches back voodoo out of the stereotype and uses that as a cleansing mechanism to save Mama Waldy from the Blackula taint. I think that's interesting in when you're talking about Black horror versus... I don't know, like Serpent in the Rainbow or Angel Heart. Mark, help me out. I'm sure there are others.
The Believers. Yeah. I think we found that typically if the lead characters, the central characters are Black, or if there's Black people behind the scenes, it's to come off a lot better. Movies like, you know, Eve's Body or stuff like that, where the scene is kind of a healing force, not something necessarily done for Eve. I think that's a really good, you know, caveat to the portrayal of the voodoo.
Yeah, which is not entirely surprising, right? The dynamic of white people doing white stuff, and like it is going to be more demonizing by default because of white supremacy of voodoo and those sorts of things. But I'm also, as you were talking, Robin, I was drawn into this, I don't know where in the history of my education I heard this or learned this, but I think there is this space within marginalized groups that when doing something, so in this case, when doing horror, because there is already a marginalization because of racism and white supremacy, then the normal rules of Catholicism must always be the good thing, and voodoo must always be the bad thing kind of dynamic gets, like, we're already breaking the rules by not having it centered on whiteness. And so there's more space to then break other rules. And I think that's the case also when it comes to like queerness and the ways that queerness and horror or queerness, like that they can play with the rules in a different way. And I'm curious how you've seen the kind of the interplay with queerness and Black horror in particular.
Me? So I'll turn it over to Mark. Mark, you can certainly help me with this one. But the first is, I think the first part of your kind of conversation is really interesting, and that continues about the ways in which Black religion is redemptive and has to be sort of necessarily socially and politically so because of the sort of other thing that's out there is what you call white horror, which is in some ways so representationally damaging through either inclusion or exclusion. Either the Black guy dies first or they're erased from the screen and have no visibility, which means no contribution to the culture. I think that's what you're getting at. And so we also know that there's, you know, like a director out there who seeks to intentionally remedy that with a particular methodology, and that's Jordan Peele. We now talk about the Jordan Peele methodology, which is the Black guy's not going to die first. In fact, the Black guy is likely not going to die at all, which makes the work that he does in writing and directing so amazingly amazing, because how do you create tension when you know Mark's not going to die today, Robin's not going to die today, but it is still horror and you're still afraid for them. But going into it, you think it's unlikely that they're going to perish. I think that's the skill of Jordan Peele. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, if we're going to dovetail into, you know, queer representation with Black horror, I mean, it's a difficult area to generalize just because it's been so hard to find. I mean, researching this book, it's like, you know, it's a marginalized area within a marginalized area. So it's there's already, you know, blackness is already a reason for Hollywood to push these characters to the side. But then, you know, if they're gay on top of that or queer on top of that, then just another reason, you know, not even exist really. So it really was a difficult proposition in this book, but I mean, there are some interesting representations that we came across. I mean, one that I thought that I hadn't really been familiar across was a, I think it's a film called Macumba Sexual from 1980 that has a the villain is this kind of voodooish priestess, but the actress who portrays it, the character, is actually a trans woman, Ajita Wilson, I think. But it was fascinating to me to just discover this kind of revolution back, you know, plus years ago. I don't think it's debatable whether or not, you know, we acknowledged her as being trans. It sounded, you know, fascinating as something that was out there, you know, a fairly well-known horror director too, Jess Franco. So, I mean, it was, you know, fairly well-known within us. So it's just something I thought was really, like I said, it really, you know, was difficult to kind of generalize, you know, Black queer representation instances, but we kind of, you know, we did the best we can. We kind of, you know, the Black queer representation in a lot of ways is kind of has the same shortcomings as the queer representation of any other. I think a lot of the male gay representation is a sassy sidekick, kind of, while the female queer representation more sexual. There's a lot of, like, you know, semi-nude sex scene, that sort of thing, sort of civilization kind of. I think, you know, it kind of in that way kind of transcends race, the representation. But really, that was kind of the area of the book that I thought I kind of went in the most blind and eye-opening to me to research. So.
I think I will add that there's one sort of movie that it's a limited series that I wish had come out so that we could have included it in the book that I'll be talking a lot about in the coming days. And that's Swarm, which I actually, so I was I really liked Swarm, and I was a little bit nervous because I knew that the character Dre was going to be queer. And what I was afraid of is that it was going to come off as that, like, spoiler alert, she's a serial killer, that they were going to tie that to some kind of, right, this implied deficiency based on her identity. So I love that was not the case, right? Mm-hmm. Dre is complex on so many levels. And because, right, you pay attention to, like, when does the kill happen? When does that show up? Because when she's ultimately in the same-sex relationship, that happens so late, sort of farther along in the movie. There's no way that the audience comes away going, oh, that's what was up. I appreciate that. I do think that horror writers and directors are still struggling with how to represent. And I do think that this was an indication of how that can happen without falling into the trap of, like, sexuality deficiency and deviant. Yeah. I really appreciated that.
So awesome. We do boot tubes, which are, like, on our Patreon, where we cover television shows as opposed to movies. And so Swarm is on my list to cover soon. I really am excited for that one. I know we're running a little close to the end of our time. So I was originally going to ask you all about some of the stuff we're covering. But just for our audience at home, this season is all about ghosts. We're doing Ghostbusters as our main franchise we're covering. And then we're doing a few other films like Candyman and stuff like that in there. But I just have to read this line from your book, just as for our listeners at home, to get a taste of the humor and fun in this book. One of the movies we're covering is Ghost with Patrick Swayze and Whoopi Goldberg. And you go in the first chapter, you have this great discussion of the archetypes of different characters. And Whoopi Goldberg's character, of course, shows up as a magical Negro. And I just love this line. Why, for the love of God, couldn't Oda Mae Brown, Whoopi Goldberg in 1990s Ghost, give herself a better name? These are the mysteries of life that only a magical Negro can answer. So just a taste for our listeners at home of the humor of this book. I love it.
That is awesome. Yeah. but in the realm of favorite of movies and stuff, I am curious what your favorite movie and or, like, black character that makes it to the end might be.
I know what Robbins will be. Maybe better than she does.
What is mine? Besides horror noir documentary 2019.
Right,
what is
obviously.
It?
Obviously that one. But addition to that.
I would say for Robin, it would be Attack the Block.
I love the Attack the Block. I love Attack the Block. Yes, that's true. What's yours?
I mean, I'm fond of, like, probably Us, I guess, with in some way Lupita makes it to the end and some of them one of her does, one of her lives, one of her dies. we're not sure who's who, which one's which, but I just love, you know, I mean, I love her performance and the duality of her, all the messages you can read into. So I think
awesome. And I
hear John Boyega is going to return to Attack the Block, that there's going to be an Attack the Block 2. So he's bringing Moses back.
I did not even hear that. Wow. That's awesome. Very excited. I wonder, first of all, since we're near the end of our time, just thank you both so much for taking the time to join us and talk about this book. And listeners will have it linked in the show notes. Definitely pick up a copy yourself if you can. But
or
you
request
all have
it from your library, because libraries can do that too.
Yep. But before y'all head out, do you have any upcoming projects, any social media handles, anything like that you want to promote for listeners to check you out some more?
Well, I'm at Blackula on Twitter. I nabbed that handle way back when.
Well done.
I think, you know, Robin is, I wrote something that Robin, for a anthology that Robin is actually editing. I always get the title wrong. It's the Oxford Handbook of Black Horror.
Yeah. Okay. That's what it's titled right now.
Okay.
Our so collaboration continues.
Yes, yes. So that will be coming out sometime. It actually takes a global approach to Black Horror. It explores non-American representations of Black Horror. So.
That sounds really interesting. What about you, Robin? Obviously, you have an anthology coming out.
Yes. So that's coming out. What else? There's so much going on because I also am very busy in my day job, which, you know, is I think that's important to sort of name, is that there is a connection between my scholarship and particularly horror and my work as a chief diversity officer at Northwestern University. Mm-hmm. And both roles speak to this, you know, sort of quest for social justice. And how people show up in sort of liberated spaces, and horror reminds you that if you don't do that in a super civil way, like we'll give you a shot, then we're going to have to come back in a really uncivil way and talk to you about how you've been treating us. In my job as chief diversity officer, we still play in the civil sandbox and try to seek resolution and, you know, strategies of inclusion and belonging in that way. But both are about the same subjects. And I think that's important.
And do you have any social media handles that you want to share so people can, if people want to follow you? It's okay.
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. I think it's @MeansColeman on Twitter. But I actually don't know. I was like, please don't ask me that question. I think that's what it is. I know Mark's.
I just looked it up. It is @MeansColeman. You're okay. Right. And we'll also have it linked in the show notes. So they can click on that too.
Mark's is the best. I love it.
Right?
Yes. It is.
Love it. You must be like early Twitter adopter to have grabbed the name like Black. Oh, that's awesome.
I occasionally get the inquiries on to whether I can somebody my hand. but I'm holding on to it.
Sure, for sure. Before we go, I'm going to just borrow one last question from our sibling podcast, Nerds at Church, which is, do you have anything just about life, the universe, or anything you just want to share for the good of our listeners before we say adieu?
I mean, the book is about, it's kind of a history book, and I think, you know, it's important to remember history, especially in this day and age where it's kind of being wiped out and the inconvenient portions of history are being erased. And so I think it's to document these types of, people won't forget how things were, how things are, how they became the way they are. So
I think that's super powerful. I would end there. That's really important.
Well, just once again, thank you so much. I love the book. I love this chance and opportunity to talk to you. And if you ever have a little bit of free time and want to hop on the podcast again to talk some movies, totally down for that. It'd be so fun. But you both have been so awesome. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Awesome. And that is it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt May. Horror Nerds at Church releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, BooTube episodes, and more bonus content by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. It's only $5 to sign up, which is much less costly than forgetting our history. Follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram @HorrorNerdsAtChurch, and Twitter @HNACPOD for all the latest updates about upcoming films, news, and other announcements. Until next time, go buy or request The Black Guy Dies First.
Yay. Thank you.